Hi, it's Beth. I am so excited to share with you my conversation with Jane Ferguson about her incredible book, No Ordinary Assignment. I loved reading this book. I loved talking with Jane. It's so exciting to get to bring a book to even greater life when you meet with the author and get to ask all the questions that you were scribbling in the margins as you were reading. These are the types of conversations that you can hear as part of our premium community content, which we like to call the Spice Cabinet. You'll hear another great author interview with Marissa Moss on our premium channels today. We hope you'll join us there by joining on Apple Podcast subscriptions or Patreon. Thank you so much. Well, we're talking to a group of people, many of whom will have read the book by the time they hear this conversation. And I know that they're going to have lots of questions about your writing process. So I wanted to start there if we could. As I was reading the book, I have two daughters. They both were very interested in what I was reading because you have such an arresting cover. And my older daughter, Jane, has been talking to me about what's in the book and what should she understand about it. And I said, this is one that I would really love for you to read. And it made me wonder, as I'm telling my seventh grader, you should read this book, who you wrote this book for? Who was the audience that you had in mind as you were working on the book?
Thank you for asking that question, because I love that question. You know, I wrote the book for anybody, really. You know, I very much so didn't want to write just for foreign correspondents to read. You know, as journalists read each other's books. I wanted predominantly, though, to really write this book for young people. I was increasingly concerned by how much, like, the more successful I was becoming professionally, the more I was doing these events where I would talk to young people, young journalists or students, and I could see them looking at me and starting to ask questions that told me they thought I had all of it figured out, that I had had this incredibly successful, straight trajectory, upward ascent in my career. And it mattered to me to tell those young people that that was absolutely not the case, that I have failed, I have fallen on my face, I have massively doubted myself, I've struggled, and that's normal and that's totally fine. And it mattered to me that young people didn't let things stop them. You know, there were so many moments in my career where I could have just given up, and I wanted young people to see what it really is like, warts and all, so they wouldn't feel as though they were failing, or, you know, no matter what career they're in, something competitive, something highly ambitious, something people tell you not to bother even trying with. I wanted them to see what the real underbelly of actually making your dreams come true looks like, so that they wouldn't give up.
And in your case, what that looks like took so much resourcefulness. You know, I was doing the math, so I'm a few years older than you. I think about the time that you were learning Arabic in Yemen, I was starting my career in a law firm. And I was so frustrated as a new lawyer at the fact that I was showing up every day waiting for someone to give me work to do, because I thought, you're paying me, I would like to work. And I didn't really understand how long it takes to build a pipeline of work. And I felt so bratty reading your book and thinking about the fact that you're out there doing the work and saying, will someone please pay me for this incredibly valuable, risky, dangerous thing I'm attempting to give you? So tell me about where you think you got that inner resolve. Like, I am just going to do the work and trust that it will pay off at some point.
You know, I think a big part of it was the fact that I didn't really want to do anything else. You know, I had this calling since I was a little girl. This is kind of all that I wanted to do. And the reality is I didn't really have a plan B. I decided I'd rather be broke doing what I love and, you know, struggling and trying to do that than give up. And on top of that, I also just had to have a blind faith that it would somehow work out. I look back at that young girl now and I smile at her optimism, you know? I mean, it's great that I was so naive, because if I'd been more wily and worldly, I probably might have quit, you know? So I think that I had to believe it was going to work out for me. Also, there are career struggles, but in between all of those career, you know, fears, trying to make ends meet, trying to pay the bills, struggling and failing to pay the bills, there are also these moments where you recognize that you absolutely love the work. You know, I mean, I had such incredible moments on the road. I felt so connected to the storytelling and to the people that really buoyed me and kept me moving forward. You know, I had to believe that something I loved so much and that I was slowly figuring out how to do well would eventually work out for me.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
In the vein of young people beginning their careers, I'm interested in how it is that you came to develop the understanding required to put yourself in these situations of the places that you were going. I know you spent time learning the language and that you really invested in personal relationships with the people who were shepherding you through these different spots in the world. But just understanding all of the interests at stake, the why of the conflicts that you were walking into, how did you develop that knowledge?
From a very young age, I was interested in the nuances of conflict. You know, growing up in Northern Ireland, I was fascinated by all the gray areas, all the sort of moral conundrums, and how I knew instinctively, because of my experiences as a kid, that there wasn't really kind of, you know, a black and white to any of these stories. Mm-hmm. There was always more to learn and more to understand. That developed into a young person, a teenager and a young adult, who really had a voracious desire to understand the, you know, the broader geopolitics of what was going on. I had a natural sense of curiosity, and that's what drove me to really, really understand. But beyond that, what I wanted to do, and of course now this is me articulating it in sort of grand sentences. At the time, I couldn't have told you what it was. It was just instinctive. What I really wanted to do was to take the understanding of these big geopolitical stories and make them personal. You know, conflict is experienced on an individual personal level, you know, and that means, you know, the cat is missing and dad went out and never came back. And now we're living in a tent and I don't understand, but we can't go to school anymore. And, you know, this is how war is experienced. And that it mattered to me that I got in there and understood and heard from people in all of their myriad of experiences.
I just think it's inspiring because growing up in America, our view of the Middle East, as it translated to me, a young girl growing up in Kentucky, was sort of first, just tell me who the bad guys are, and we're going to assume that we're the good guys. And then as I got a little older, it was more like, well, tell me who our allies are and who our enemies are. And then I came to understand that it depends on which conflict we're talking about, because we are allies in some fights and enemies in others. And just all of the ways that, and I'm sure your childhood influenced your ability to parse these things, but all of the ways that ethnicity and religion and oil and other resources come to bear country by country. I'm just trying to imagine like a late 20s version of myself being able to keep all of that straight as I'm making my way around the region.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly complicated. It's important to have a really good basis of understanding. And a lot of that came from, A, as you've said, like the childhood where I understood that there were always, like that there was no true, clear moral high ground. You know, mm-hmm. it was fluid. It moved around. Like in Northern Ireland, we had, you know, I could see bigotry. I could see prejudice from just enough of a distance where I could see that people would say, well, those Catholics, they support the IRA and they're terrorists. But then on the other hand, you had people on the other side saying, well, you know, those Protestants, they're all part of a colonial empire here. And they're, you know, we don't have our rights that should be God given to us. And so I understood that, you know, that sort of nuance that both sides had. And so that was important. But coming into it as well, I applied that by understanding that almost everybody has a value system. And whenever we say who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, we're kind of telling ourselves a little lie that, you know, that those people are bad because they have no values. But very often they do. They're just very different. Even the Taliban have a value system. And it's one that it can be so antithetical to everything we believe is right. So having, you know, the ability to understand that, and it's not to excuse acts of violence and cruelty and terrorism, but to understand where they come from, was something that did come from a childhood. But another big part of my work that I tried to really convey in the book is that I was often fortunate enough to work with a lot of local journalists, local colleagues, whether they were Yemeni or Afghan or Iraqi or Syrian. And it's really through them and through listening to them and actually really genuinely letting them lead you and teach you that you come to understand these things. You know, I've been fortunate enough to work with local people who've trusted me and talked to me at length about what's really going on. And that's really where you start to learn.
And I feel like you beautifully express in the book how lucky you are that you've been able to trust them. It is easy to imagine in any one of these situations you being betrayed by the people who were there to help you. And I wonder if you know, you talk a little bit about relying on your instincts. I wonder if there have been moments where you've looked at the fixer or the local guide and thought, I don't know.
There have. You know, the reality is people have different pressures in their life. They have different priorities. Some people are blackmailed. Some people are desperate for money. Some people feel, you know, more of a loyalty more to their family, their community. So you have to be realistic about placing yourself within a very complex place. You know, I was lucky enough over the years to go back to places again and again and again. So many of the people to whom I would trust my life were people I'd known for many, many years. You know, I'd sat around their dinner table, I'd bounced their babies on my knee. There were other instances where that had not happened and where people were absolutely new and where I was very unsure if I could trust them. An example would be whenever I was smuggled into Syria in early 2012. I didn't know these guys. I had been introduced by contacts of contacts of contacts, and I really didn't know at any moment. And there were moments where I was suspicious and fearful. But very often in those situations, you either decide that you have no choice but to trust this person, or you pull out. You have to somehow learn to make peace with a sense of not quite knowing if you can trust someone.
or a place. I could not believe it. I was like talking out loud to the book. No, no, no. When you went back to the hotel where you had experienced gunfire and being under siege years later, and I would love to know what you were thinking in that time.
Well, it was let's just say there wasn't a big choice of hotels in Kabul by 2020, and 2019 when I had returned. So in 2014, the Serena Hotel in Afghanistan was attacked by the Taliban while I was inside. I made it out alive, obviously, but it was a very, very frightening experience for me as a young reporter in my late 20s. I was really shaken by that. And I remember afterwards being sent on assignment to Kenya, not too long afterwards. And I was in Nairobi, and I was in this beautiful hotel in Nairobi that is, you know, an old heritage hotel. It's been there a long time. And it has this gorgeous sort of garden outside. And I remember I would like walk around the perimeter, and I was just always checking. I was afraid of intruders. And I left, I had like one of those little like, you know, terraces where I would go out through, I could access the garden direct from my room. And I went outside. I was a smoker at the time, as you will have picked up in the book. And I was doing that thing where I was sort of looking around, and I was nervous about anybody who could get in, and the door clicked behind me, and I had to walk back through the kitchen and through the restaurant in my bare feet and dressing gown in my bathrobe to get back into the hotel because I'd been doing a perimeter walk and locked myself out. So I was nervous. I was really shaken by that. But, you know, to go back to Afghanistan meant going back and finding a hotel to stay in. And the Serena Hotel was the hotel, which was ironically the only semi-secure hotel. It hadn't been breached since then. That had been 5 years before. And so, you know, I simply had to face my fears and go back in and get on with my work.
I could have read an entire second book on your experiences in Afghanistan. I was really struck by your description of how the Taliban felt to women and children like our neighbors are suddenly willing to sell us, rape us, you know, the personal nature of those, the intimacy, I guess, is the word I'm looking for, of the communities, and seeing how quickly people turn to enemies really affected me. I don't think I've heard it described so clearly that way before. And I wonder what lessons you relate to your students now about capturing that kind of observation.
You know, students ask a lot of the time, you know, how do we interview people who have been through such unbelievable trauma, horrific trauma, like rape as a weapon of war. And how do we capture those experiences? And I often say, well, first and foremost, you know, we've really got to make sure people have a support system when you're interviewing them, that they have people around them. But beyond that, I think a huge amount of my work, and I'm always telling young journalists and students this, is listening. You know, when people ask, how do you capture interviews like that? How do you, you know, what questions should you ask? And how is it done? They're very much so asking me what the action should be. But I often remind them that interviewing is really about listening. People want to tell you their stories. I've so rarely, rarely found people say, no, I don't want to talk to you. It's very rare. People want to talk. They just don't want you to come at them with an answer in mind. They don't want you to come at them like with pecking at questions because there are specific details they want to jot down in their diary, in their notebooks, and then move on. They want someone to listen to them. And so my interviews over the years have been very long. You know, they're very organic. They're just sitting down and talking to people about their experiences and often letting those people lead the conversation. And that is, I think, what's most important. And people know when you're listening to them. They really know. They know when you are authentically listening and responding to their actual answers. And I think they really appreciate that. And that's how they open up and talk to you about that. It is difficult to talk to people about, not difficult, but it's important. It's important to, I find television is one of the best mediums for communicating the emotion behind quotes and interviews. And when you're talking to someone about something so bitter and betrayal laden as sectarian violence or what, you know, the what ISIS did to Yazidi women in Iraq, things like that, when you're talking to people about forgiveness, about the bitterness it may have it planted inside of them, I think it's very important to capture that on camera because it's very hard to relay in print. And so that mattered to me, that people were able to be honest about their feelings and reflect on them and that we could capture them in that way.
You know how you learn to really appreciate how good your products are? Leave town and get stuck with whatever shampoo is in the hotel. I take Pros and their custom hair products for granted, y'all. Pros is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. From millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely yours or mine. I never found beauty products that really understood my needs, but ever since I switched to custom hair and skin routine with Pros, I've noticed so many benefits. My thin hair is moisturized but not weighed down, and my waves have never looked better. And Pros isn't just better for you, it's better for the planet. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, "I cannot believe how young you look." And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off. In previous episodes, I have outed myself as a bed-making fanatic. I am very serious about my bed being an oasis, a gift to Chad and me as we crawl into it at the end of a long day. So I want to return to how much I love my Boll & Branch sheets. With Boll & Branch sheets, you can discover a new level of softness. The sheets are made from 100% organic cotton in a buttery, breathable weave that truly gets softer every time you wash them. And you know that I like to do that once a week, so my Boll & Branch are rapidly aging like a fine wine. The sheets look great. I have them in a beautiful slate color. They stay put, so making my bed is quick and easy. They are a bestseller for a reason. The signature sheets feel incredible on night one. They are loved by millions of sleepers, and they come with a 30-night worry-free guarantee. Sleep better at night with the softest sheets from Boll & Branch. Get 15% off your first order when you use promo code PANTSUIT at bollandbranch.com. That's Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com, promo code PANTSUIT. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Do you think that there was a difference in people's ability to relay their story so vulnerably to you in these horrible moments when you were filming all by yourself versus when you had more of a team with you? I think about how intimidating I find it to be when there's like a camera crew around. And I wonder if you observed a difference.
It's a great question, you know, because technical things matter. Like they have an impact. You know, the interesting thing is, I would say there's actually a happy medium. You know, because I've worked with much smaller budgets and therefore much smaller teams, especially with PBS, you know, the bulk of my career in public broadcasting, you know, we don't have two camera people, a sound person, several producers. You know, we work, and I've always worked with a very lean team, and as many of them being locals as possible, as many of them being from the country, preferably from the area. So that helps to be with someone from the area. But I would say actually having a camera person, a cameraman or woman, actually helps rather than hinders the intimacy. And the reason is I'm not distracted. You know, they're handling, you know, are the batteries full? You know, is it in focus? Is the sound working? Wait, let me check that microphone. If I'm asking someone about something that's so intimate and so personal, but I'm half distracted with equipment, I actually find, like, as with you or I, with any of us, we'd be put off by that. You know, that's immediately when you start to see someone's guard come up, you know, and so you can actually lose the connection because you're so busy dealing with the massive, you know, logistics of TV, which is just enormous, you know, batteries and cameras and microphones and light and the sunlight and in focus or out of focus. It's so antithetical to making a connection to someone as they talk about something personal. So I actually prefer to have a camera person with me, but I prefer to have it a very, very, very small team. And anybody else there, if they're local and from the area, that's helpful rather than, you know, like a big army of strangers.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about how many times during the book you mentioned that sense of like not pressing someone too far, letting them lead the conversation, and how there were times when you shut down someone else asking a question with an agenda to get like the most sort of made for TV gripping. I think you called it the bang bang of a story at one point. I want to make a connection and see if this rings true to you, because as I was reading the book, I thought, I'm reading this woman's memoir and she's sharing some very personal things, but also I would describe her after reading it as extremely private. And I wonder if you came to that sort of gate with a person you were interviewing through the lens of your own kind of sense of like, that's enough. Like, I've shared enough about this and I'm moving on now.
You know, it's so interesting, because I share so much in the book. No one's described it as like, as showing me as a private person. But I think what you're getting at, and it's quite right, is that I always had, there's a discomfort that runs throughout the book, that runs throughout my work, much as I love it and I believe in it, and it's a calling for me. There was always a discomfort in what, you know, am I helping people and they're sharing these experiences? And I worry that it's a voyeuristic act. You know, on the one hand, I believe in it. I believe that we hold a mirror up to the world and that these stories connect people. They very often hold governments to account for the decisions, you know, the impact they have. But that's a very, very, these are like very grand ideals. When I'm sitting in front of someone, I worry that I'm not helping them, and I'm always aware that, you know, this is possibly the worst moment in their life. This is a really tough time. They're in a refugee camp. They're in a hospital. I very much so, they're in line for food aid. You know, I'm just so aware that this person is someone who needs help, and I'm not giving it to them. Like, I'm providing a service more broadly, but not to this person. And so it feels like, because of that, I've always carried this sort of slight discomfort. And I try to handle that by not approaching them with a sense of entitlement to all of their emotions all of the time. Mm-hmm. Added to that is the fact that I'm very, certainly over the years, as I've spent more time in these countries, I've come to understand that people do not have the resources, the emotional resources and support that many of us do in the West, and that a certain degree of resolve and stoicism is absolutely necessary for survival. People don't have access to therapy and therapists, or even just family and friends who even understand, you know, and are super literate in emotional health. So to get through the kind of intense experiences that they're going through, they need sometimes that level, that they need sometimes to not have their defenses broken down. And so I think it's important to respect that.
I love that reminder that we are a highly therapy-dependent society here, especially in the U.S., and that is not true everywhere. And I also loved the reminder that the ice cream in Afghanistan was delicious and that there were foods that you loved in Beirut, even though the water wasn't always consistent, and just that humor is so important to soldiers.
Sure. I mean, there's so much joy. I know that it's sort of an overused phrase, people are resilient, but you know, they are my best. What I wanted to convey is, what does resilience look like? Resilience looks like jokes and music and food against the odds, you know? And I found that everywhere, absolutely everywhere. So, you know, we don't run around in this constant state of anguish and terror and sadness. You know, we experience that in an incredibly visceral way. And then we return to, you know, all of these other incredible experiences that everybody else is living through as well.
As you talked about, you know, having respect for people's emotional capacity in these terrible moments and like whether you're helping or not, I was thinking about the relationship between the personal experience of war and the policy, and especially how you're so committed when the United States withdrew from Afghanistan to kind of shift into, I actually just want to be of service to the person in front of me right now, as you were trying to help people evacuate. I would love to hear, with even more distance now than when you wrote the book, how you sort of process that decision to shift out of just storytelling and into, I am just going to be one of the hands on deck here.
I look back now with a great sense of relief, because it's so easy to get into autopilot. I'm a journalist. This is my job. That's not my job. This is all that I have to do. I'm really glad that I recognized in that moment that there are things in life that are vastly bigger than your career. You know, that if you never work another day in this business, you would never regret helping this person. You know, I think at the time I had, it came at a moment in my life where I had grown so fatigued of not helping people, you know, of going and covering a famine, but not, you know, I don't know, being a pilot who could fly in grain or you know, a diplomat who could negotiate access, you know, to humanitarian corridors for people. I had recognized, having been in the field for 15 years or you know, that this was going to go on and on and on and on the more, you know, throughout my career. And that these were moments where I would, you know, look back on as a, you know, throughout my life, and know that it mattered that I acted on my own personal values and not just my professional values. So that mattered to me. And I also just didn't feel like this compromised the work. It was a matter of priorities in terms of time. And you know, and it was, if I don't sleep, then I can get this done and do the work. And so it wasn't like, if I do this, if I help these people evacuate, I'm going to have compromised my work editorially. So that was, you know, a reality of the situation on the ground. But largely, I just, you know, wanted to act on being a human being, you know. And I was someone who found themselves in this extraordinary situation where I had a weird power that I shouldn't have had, the ability to pull people in. And that was because the system had collapsed. So I felt that if I hadn't helped, that very, very much so, these people's lives would be negatively impacted.
You just said, and this theme is present in the book too, that the conflict is going to go on and on. And you kind of end the book by saying there's always going to be another war, and there are new journalists who can go do what I did in covering that. I was just reading a piece by Yair Rosenberg about Benjamin Netanyahu and his fundamentally pessimistic view for the Middle East, and that being animating to the way that he leads Israel. And I wondered if you have a fundamentally pessimistic view after having spent and lived and loved so much of this region of the world. Do you see bright spots in the future, or do you see more and more of the kinds of conflict that you spent so much time covering?
I would say I remain very, very much so optimistic about the human capacity for hope and the human compulsion to improve your own rights, to improve your own access to the rights that you believe, you know, that you have. I think that broadly the world is improving, but where I think I have become maybe not pessimistic, but certainly more realistic is what I've learned about how difficult it is to break down power structures that repress people. You know, to have covered the Arab Spring and these enormously inspiring and exciting, heady days of young people taking to the streets and demanding their rights and watching it, you know, just wash away the strength, the seeming strength of dictatorships was incredible. And to watch as the years went by afterwards, the retreat of all of that, the pushback by the autocratic repressive forces was very heartbreaking. It was really hard to take. So I do feel a lot more trepidatious about what it takes to break free, what it takes to actually free yourself from repression. I believe that more and more that, you know, the world is very interwoven and that people, you know, people asking for the same rights in Baghdad or Sana'a as people in New York or London are inevitably going to need help. And this is the big question of our time. Intervention, you know, during the Iraq war, during the war on terror was a massive overreach by the United States. But since then, we've seen such a withdrawal that in many ways, it's been an extreme swing back whereby people have largely been abandoned, in their search for rights. So I'm not pessimistic about human nature. I'm more optimistic than ever, but I'm very realistic about what it would take to help people edge forward and improve their lot. I think it's been a very painful to watch people struggle as alone for their own rights. And then watch, you know, in many ways, nefarious actors like Putin step in and help dictatorships like Bashar al-Assad's crush his own people. So I'm more pessimistic, or certainly a little more cynical, about the global politics and what it's going to take to help people. But I'm not pessimistic about people's desire and continued insistence and belief in their own God-given rights.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. You guys, I love my Aura frames. I have one in my office. I have one in my kitchen. I have given one as a housewarming gift. I have given one as Mother's Day, Father's Day. They are the most amazing gifts because this app is a game changer, in my personal opinion, in digital frames. It makes it so, so easy to get the pictures on there and even videos. It plays like you're in Harry Potter, you guys. It is the best. I love mine so much. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
So I know that prescribing policy is not what you do, But I am really interested in what lessons you think the United States especially should take on that question of intervention, because your Afghanistan chapters make it so clear that two things were true at the same time. The Afghan people were ready for the United States to go, and the way that we left was incredibly painful and created an enormous amount of suffering. And I would just love to know what reflections you have that policymakers here should consider before we intervene again and before we exit anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's incredibly difficult to put together a specific set of circumstances. Under these specific circumstances, the United States should intervene, you know, either diplomatically or militarily. You know, it's very, very hard because we look at different situations and we wonder, you know, each country, each scenario where people are trying to keep their own human rights alive and well is different. You know, would a U.S. intervention in Iran help? I mean, it's very, very unlikely. It would certainly spark a war. But I would say this, that part of the difficulty is, especially in this era of isolationism, and we're really going through an unprecedented, certainly, you know, not since maybe the early days of the Second World War, have we seen so much isolationism, both on the left and the right in the United States. It's a little more vocal on the sort of hard right populist side, but on the left as well. This incredible sense of not in any way really engaging in the world, even, you know, providing weapons to the Ukrainians to defend themselves from an invasion. I would say this, that I think that the idea that leaving the world, withdrawing, you know, troops from everywhere, I can see that it's politically extremely expedient. It's of course popular to tell people, we don't need to be in the world. We don't need to spend money. We don't need to engage. We certainly don't need to put our lives at risk, or the lives of our citizens at risk, and sending out service members. We don't need to. We don't need them. We're fine. I can see how that's politically expedient. You know, the idea of abandoning Bagram Air Base on July 4th, declaring ourselves out of Afghanistan on September 11th. This is all very politically, appealing. But the difference between politics and reality in the world is one where I think real leadership needs to step into the space between those two. And leadership is often dealing with difficult realities. And the difficult reality I have seen in my career on the road is that withdrawing from the world completely doesn't necessarily make it a safer and fairer place. In many places, the vacuum left behind has been filled by Bashar al-Assad, or by, you know, Vladimir Putin, or by, you know, you name it. And human rights abuses are, over the last 10 years especially, have been so devastating. And so I do think that, you know, there is an impact there. There's an impact. There is a result to ignoring certain taboos being totally broken, like Bashar al-Assad gassing his own people, like Vladimir Putin invading Crimea. You know, these things end up continuing to beget more and more human rights abuses, more and more invasions. So the world becomes less stable. And before you know it, like the global world order, certainly the liberal world order, you know, is under threat. And we now have Russia on the doorstep of Europe, invading sovereign countries. So this is the painful reality that sometimes politics and politicians in the United States are not willing to say out loud whenever they're running for election. And so I think that's my big takeaway from what I've seen, you know. And it's not partisan, it's just a real realism about, you know, what's happening out there in the world.
My last question for you is a large departure from that policy question. I just want to ask how your life is now. I know that a lot has changed since the epilogue of the book. I saw on your Instagram that you seem to have had a beautiful wedding. Congratulations. And you're teaching. And so I wonder what's next for you.
Oh, it's a good question. Well, life right now is pretty lovely. I've just had a terrific summer. My fiance, who was this very nice guy, had been dating for a few months when Kabul fell, and he was very tolerant of the fact that I was in Afghanistan while the Taliban were marching into Kabul. We got married this May, just a teeny tiny wedding. We ran up to Martha's Vineyard, and it was just beautiful. And I am now teaching a course on journalism at Princeton just for the fall semester. So I'll be done by Christmas. And, you know, I think I'll continue writing. And I think I'm not hanging up my war spurs completely, but I'm certainly not living that life out on the road like I had done before. And I'm really kind of looking at pivoting, you know, and at this point in my life, I'm kind of taking stock of my life and career and kind of wondering, not entirely sure where from here, but I'm pretty excited to be a little more settled, a little more grounded. So we shall see. We shall see where this takes me next year. I'm just not sure. Maybe another book.
Well, I would love to read it. So I told you at the beginning that I'm going to have my seventh grader read your book. My third grader, after asking me lots of questions about what is this book about, said, she sounds like she would be in Gryffindor. She's like new to the Harry Potter series.
Oh my goodness, I am honored.
I thought that was a beautiful way to put it. I know that you reject the hero framing, but as I thought about hearing Ellen say that, you know, that willingness to take extraordinary risk in pursuit of one's values seems like a beautiful characterization. So thank you for the book and for spending time with me.
Thank you for your very wise and lovely daughters. That's so lovely to hear. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane.